Welcome to Post City Magazine's Streets of Toronto and Rotman School of Management 17th Annual Real Estate Roundtable. This event was recorded live in conjunction with the David Feldman Center for Real Estate and Urban Economics at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. The RE/MAX Collection is the presenting sponsor for this event. This year's event was moderated by Post City Magazine's managing editor Julia Mastrioni and Canadian broadcaster Liza Frommer. This is an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion involving nine leading real estate experts.
I'm broadcast journalist Liza Frommer, and this marks our 17th roundtable. We're grateful to be back to a sold-out crowd, not only here, but online as well. We're honored to be co-hosting the event in partnership with the Rotman School of Management, which hosts the David Feldman Center for Real Estate and Urban Economics. The center supports the creation and dissemination of knowledge in real estate and urban economics. This year's roundtable will focus on the current state of the market, first-time home buyers, and the challenges of investing and buying real estate in Toronto in 2024, and we know there are a lot of them. We would like to thank our sponsor, the RE/MAX Collection, who, for a fourth year in a row, by supporting this incredible discussion, have shown their commitment and support of real estate and educational excellence. Tonight, we are also mindful that there are many people in our city who don't have basic shelter. And with that in mind, Post City, Streets of Toronto, and the Rotman School have made donations to Sistering, an organization supporting unhoused women and trans people in Toronto, and Red Door Shelter, which provides sanctuary for families. To submit questions for the panel, please go to slido.com, that's S-L-I-D-O.com, and enter the code hashtag RERT24. If you are participating virtually, there is a link embedded just below the video, and that link will be open for 15 minutes, this first 15 minutes. We kindly ask that you refrain from recording, and please turn your phones to silent. And now, on to our esteemed panel. When you hear your name, just give it a little wave. Here they are, the HGTV host, Sebastian Clovis. He's the co-host of HGTV Canada and principal of Clovis Contracting. The sales pro, Barry Cohen, president of RE/MAX Realtron, Barry Cohen Homes. The designer, Brian Gluckstein, principal of Gluckstein Design. The banker, Benjamin Tall, deputy chief economist of CIBC World Markets. The broker, Michael Callis, president of Harvey Callis Real Estate Brokerage. The developer, Jennifer Keysmat, CEO of Collective Marquee. He's the condo king, Brad Lamb, president of Brad J. Lamb Realty and Lamb Development. And we have a couple of new panelists as well. The TikTok real estate influencer, Anya Ettinger, realtor at Bosley Real Estate. And finally, the architect, Bridget Shim, co-founder of Shim Sutcliffe Architects. This year's event will be moderated by Post City Magazine's managing editor, Julia Mastrioni, and myself. And what follows is always unscripted and unrehearsed. So let's begin, shall we? Julia, over to you.
So panelists, this is just a reminder that there will be specific questions directed to each of you during this evening's roundtable, but it's not just live, it's meant to be lively, so we encourage respectful debate. Now, as we do each year, we will kick things off with an update on the economy and interest rates from the country's top real estate economist, Benjamin Tall. Over to you, Benjamin.
Thank you very much. Listen, if the real and ultimate measure of intelligence is what you do when you don't know what to do, then the next few weeks, months, and quarters will test the economic IQ of the Bank of Canada, because they are the first to admit that they have no clue what's happening. We are all making it up as we go. So I know that by now, many of you are very disappointed. Because after all, everybody promised you a recession. And we didn't get a recession. So where is that recession? Let me tell you, we are in a recession. we are in a per capita recession. Per capita GDP is down by 2.5%. Per capita consumption is down by 3%. So the only reason why the economy is above zero is because of the fact that we got 1.2 million people into this country in a very short period of time. This is not a way to grow an economy. India also has a lot of people. What we need is GDP per capita growing, not just get more and more people into the new country without being able to grow the economy. So that's more or less where we are, and we have to improve on that. Now, let's talk about interest rates and mortgage rates and the housing market. At the end of the day, although everybody is talking about inflation, this is not about inflation. This is about the cost of bringing inflation down to 2%, which is the target. The Bank of Canada, the ECB in Europe, the Fed in the US, they have all established their reputation as inflation fighters. They will do whatever it takes to bring it back to 2%. And we can argue until we are blue in the face to what extent 2% is the right number. I don't think it's the right number. I think it's higher. Doesn't make any difference. They are not going to change it. So we are stuck with 2%. So the Bank of Canada, and that's extremely important if you care about mortgage rates. The Bank of Canada is a biased bank. You wake them up in the middle of the night and you say a recession or inflation, they will take a recession any day. So they overshoot by design. If the Bank of Canada was an AI machine, the Bank of Canada would have stopped raising interest rates 50 basis points ago. So they are overshooting big time with major implications on the real estate market. Interest rates are artificially high because they want to make sure that inflation is absolutely dead and they are overshooting. And you can overshoot in two ways. You can raise interest rates way too high and you can keep them high for too long. And they are going to do both. And that's why overshooting is extremely important. Now, we must discuss inflation, but before that, we have to realize that the GDP in Canada is now approaching zero. So we are very close to technical recession or a very, very, very soft landing. And that's exactly what the Bank of Canada would like to see. People say, you know, I had a lunch meeting with some clients and the other day, and they asked me on the way there, are you going to give us good news? And I said, depends what they are serving for lunch. And then I was thinking about it. What is good news? If tomorrow I tell you that GDP growth is 5%, very strong, the labor market is generating 100,000 new jobs, very strong, is it good news or bad news? Well, for the Bank of Canada, is a nightmare. It is a nightmare because they want to see the economy slowing down. So listen to this because that's important. Bad news is good news because it means that the Bank of Canada will not be raising more if you have bad news. So bad news is good news. And if bad news is good news, I have plenty of good news from you today. So the point that I'm making here is the following. Inflation, and I have 4 minutes left. Let's talk about inflation, because when you think about interest rates, when you talk to clients, you have to discuss inflation. And I believe that all those major inflationary forces that were unfolding are now turning into disinflationary forces. Very quickly, food. We all go to the supermarket. We're all overwhelmed by the fact that food prices are crazy. The Bank of Canada does not care. Not because of the fact that they are not nice people, but because of the fact, listen to this, inflation is a rate of change. It's not the level of prices. So if food prices last year went up by 10% and now they're rising by only 5%, but still rising, that's disinflationary, not inflationary. And that's exactly what's happening. Supply chain is back to normal. This means that prices of goods are starting to go down. We have a situation in which the Bank of Canada is now more able to deal with inflation because we have a situation in which all the inflation during COVID was coming from outside the country, supply inflation. The Bank of Canada was impotent in its ability to deal with it because, believe me, Putin does not care about the fact that the Bank of Canada is raising interest rates. But now all the inflation is coming from domestic forces sensitive to higher interest rates. And then you have supply chain and profit margins among retailers. Let's face it, many retailers were hiding behind the fog of supply chain. You went to the store, you asked for this dishwasher, and they said, you know, supply chain, Russia, China. But if you pay a bit more, we'll find one for you in the basement. That's exactly what happened. Now, no place to hide because supply chain is back to normal and retail prices are actually going down. So that's disinflationary. And then very important, shoot, I don't have much time. Interest payments on mortgages. How do we measure shelter prices, shelter inflation? It's not the price of units. It's real estate agents' commission. It's rent. But the most important one is what? Mortgage interest payments. Now think about it for a second. The Bank of Canada is raising interest rates to fight inflation. Higher interest rates are adding to inflation through mortgage interest payments that are rising by 30% a year. It's madness. Nobody will be able to convince me that higher mortgage interest payments are disinflationary. So what we are saying here is the following. If you remove mortgage interest payments, and by the way, the Bank of Canada is one of the only banks in the universe that use mortgage interest payments in the CPI. What happens if you remove mortgage interest payments from the calculations? Inflation is 1.5%, already below target. And that's why the Bank of Canada is overshooting. Still, the Bank of Canada today announced that they're not going to raise interest rates, but not giving us hints when they're going to cut. So I'll tell you when they're going to cut, June. June will be the first cut. I think they're ready for that, and they will start hinting in April that they're ready to do so. By how much? Very quickly. We started this saga at 175 overnight rate. We are at 5 now, staying there until June. Go down to what? I said 275. Write it down. I probably will be wrong, but... Now, why 275 in the last minute that I have? Because when you think about real estate, when you think about the economy, you have to ask yourself the following question. To what extent COVID is an event or a condition, economically speaking? And I say, economically speaking, it's a condition because it accelerated so many forces and trends. We all know the story. One of them is deglobalization that is now actually inflationary, replacing globalization that was disinflationary. We used to have just-in-time inventories that was actually disinflationary. Now we have just-in-case inventories, inflationary. The labor market used to be giving, forgiving. Now it's tight, inflationary. And all those green initiatives, they're inflationary. Four inflationary forces, the target is 2%. Clearly, by definition, interest rates have to be higher than they were before. And let me remind you that the real estate market in Canada can do extremely well. The real estate market in Toronto can do extremely well at a 3% overnight rate if we know the direction and if we are in equilibrium. Interest rates were too low. 3% will be the right number, and this guy will do fine when interest rates are 3%. Done. 2 seconds left. Wow.
Thank you so much, Benjamin. And I know we're all going to keep our eye on June now. this year, we'll ask Barry Cohen, the country's top carriage trade agent, for an update on the current state of the condo, home, and investment property market. So over to you, Barry.
Says I got 55 minutes.
Okay, there you go.
Well, to understand what's in store for 2024, I think we have to first understand what happened in 2023. 2023 was full of uncertainty, a lot of stops and goes. At the end of the year, the stats were very simple. Condos and freehold pretty much were the same. They each dropped about 5 to 5.5% in value. And activity was down 12% in both categories. Sellers were holding back. So we were inventory challenged, and it's a good lot of reason why we had fewer sales. And it was a very challenging year because interest rates were climbing until about the summer. And then they leveled off. And interesting, when they leveled off, you saw that the market became vibrant. Higher end was buying, was moving. And then our new mayor came up with the new land transfer tax, can't say initiative, but, and things just stopped. And, you know, we're moderately busy in every category. And then lo and behold, I started noticing that the wealthy around October were buying real estate to avoid the new tax rates, which in some cases was an increase of 1% to 5%. And they're buying as long as they can close by December. And I thought that that was unexpected, because I thought that the rich might stand on the sidelines and say, hey, you know, if rates are going to not change or go up, prices are going to fall, and I'll wait till next year. Or I'll avoid the tax, and I'll wait till next year and maybe get it for 90 cents on the dollar. But they were buying. And that was great. And then all of a sudden, Benjamin Tall came out, I think it was about the end of November, with his prediction that rates would fall somewhere between 1% and 1.5%. And what happened was, I felt in December, Michael might share that opinion, that it continued to be busy irrespective of the closing date. There was this optimism. And that's the way we started the year, 2024, optimism. So far, it's go, 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 not stop, go, stop. So, you know, you have this optimism. The Toronto Real Estate Board reported at the end of January, sales are up 37%. And sales are up in February. That just came up. The two averaged out to be over 18% of the same time last year. I mean, that's very good. But what it doesn't talk to is the different categories. You have to understand that when the Toronto Real Estate Board reports, 98% of their data is for homes under $2.5 million. If I should sell an $8 million, a $10 million, or a $20 million house tonight, it won't change the stat. And so when you look specifically, the low end under $3 million is roaring. The up to 3 to 5 is moving. Over 5 is sluggish. When you go over 7.5 million, it's just completely at a stop. That will change. As if Benjamin is right and interest rates will go down, then I think that the balance between lower interest rates and paying the higher land taxes will serve the high-end buyers and sellers well. Thank you.
So we're going to move on to our next section. It's about first-time home buyers. So everybody is very concerned about the first-time home buyer, whether you're the prime minister or a parent. How have things changed for the first-time buyer in 2024 in Toronto? So we'll start with Jennifer, and then we'll move on to Anya.
Well, this is a great question, because the foundation of the Canadian dream for so many years was access to home ownership and becoming a first-time home buyer. And of course, over the course of the past several years, that is something that has fundamentally shifted, and access to home ownership has increasingly become out of reach. So if we look in the Toronto context, in 1970, the average price of the average home was about 2 times the average salary. Today, it's 10 times the average salary. In Vancouver, it's 12 times the average salary. So accessing home ownership is something that has increasingly been a dream that many people cannot attain. And that is something that has only accentuated and become more extreme in the context of increasing interest rates. Ironically, I had a colleague who was looking at a condo and wanted to buy a condo. She looked at it a few years ago. It was, you know, way out of her price range. About 3 months ago, it looked like the price had dropped significantly. And she thought, fantastic, now's my time to get into the market. And so I said, well, just go play around with that mortgage calculator a minute. And she did. And of course, given interest rates, the carrying cost of the condo was actually higher at a significantly lower purchase price than it was back when interest rates were much lower. So this idea that the average worker in the city of Toronto and that the average household can access home ownership is something that has increasingly been moving beyond reach. Is there reason to despair? I would say no. I think there's only reason to despair if we can't figure out a way to consistently continue building homes. That's actually the bigger risk that we face. Most people in our city, and most people particularly coming into this city as newcomers, their first aspiration is actually stable housing. And stable housing can be high quality rental housing if we are building high quality rental housing that is stable. For a very long time, we used the condo market to offset a lack of new purpose-built rental. We have some pretty powerful incentives coming forward right now from the federal government, including the forgiveness of GST on purpose-built rentals. But there's still a lot of other factors that are making it incredibly difficult just to bring any type of housing supply to the market right now. So all of that wonderful immigration, which is not the right way to grow the economy, I heard from Benjamin, also had the unintended impact of really further tightening our housing supply and access to housing for newcomers and for young people, resulting in a whole series of incredibly wonky outcomes in terms of our labor market, for example. Many young people working in the city of Toronto today have the unenviable situation of an hour or an hour and a half commute because people are moving farther and farther outside of the urban core. Remote work has helped a little bit. Now you don't have to commute 5 days a week. Maybe it's four, maybe it's three, but it's having a phenomenal quality of life impact. So the upshot of all of that is that we deceive ourselves if we focus on first-time home buyers as being the fundamental challenge that we face as a society and as a growing as a society that wants a growing economy and that needs immigration. We have to be thinking more broadly about access to housing, and in particular, affordable housing that is in close proximity to transit and other urban amenities that present the opportunity of living without a car, the opportunity of living a little bit smaller, in exchange for living in a fantastic urban environment. But if we don't deliver on the urban environment, and if we simply don't deliver on the housing, all of that part of the dream will fall apart and crumble as well. So we've got some pretty big, significant challenges that we face that are, I would say, quite different than the challenges we've ever faced on this panel before and that we've ever talked about on this panel before, including this challenge of how we build enough homes to respond to the demand and the need. And when I say homes, I'm talking about, of course, both rental and own, but how we build enough homes to respond to the immigration, which it seems like isn't going to be abated at any time in the near future.
Anya, go ahead.
We've really gotten into quite a lose-lose situation in Toronto. Home ownership is a huge goal that a lot of people, you know, a lot of my peers have, but it is so unattainable. It is so out of reach that a lot of, you know, people in their 20s, even their early 30s, are wondering if it's ever going to be a possibility. Now, I mean, that's a combination of high borrowing costs and it being extremely difficult to qualify for a mortgage, especially as a single person. But on top of that, being able to save up for enough for a down payment. So if you don't have help from parents or from family or have come into a large sum of money, it is virtually impossible for the average Canadian, the average Torontonian to get into the housing market on their own. Now, the other side of that lose-lose is a lot of people are being forced out of rentals because rental prices are going up. So to afford to buy, you know, a starter condo, you need to be making at least $100,000 to be able to qualify for a mortgage. But to, you know, be able to afford an average priced one bedroom rental as a single person, if you follow the, you know, 30% rule, you need to be making $80,000. So it's not all that much cheaper to be renting either. So we've really gotten into a tough spot because it's too expensive to rent, it's too expensive to buy. And now a lot of people, especially young people, are being forced to decide, well, where am I going to put my money? Am I going to have to sacrifice, you know, certain things and locations to be able to simply have my own place? Or am I going to have to live with roommates until I'm 30 or 40? So that's a really big struggle on top of, you know, now we have a new first home savings account with a very low yearly limit. So it's going to take you 10 years to have enough to put down 20% if you're exclusively using that account. So there are so many barriers for people that want to get into the market as, you know, a first-time home buyer that I'm seeing a lot of people, a lot of prospective clients, and even just consumers I'm speaking to that are really struggling to find a way, a path. They don't know where to go. They don't know where to look. There's so much misinformation. There's so much distrust between the consumer and the real estate industry as a whole that I'm finding people are just really lost and they don't know where to go. So they're looking to people for guidance and they're looking to resources. But with all the conflicting information and a very uncertain environment and climate, you know, that we've seen over the last few years, they're really just not sure what to do. And I think that, you know, trying to change A, our legislation so that there is more trust between the consumer and the real estate industry, so they don't feel as though they're being lied to or they're being screwed over. But also putting in, you know, building more housing, building more livable housing. Condos are getting smaller and smaller. People are needing to make more and more sacrifices to get really just their foot into the door. So there needs to be a shift in both the buyer's mindset or the renter's mindset. And there are certain things I'm going to need to sacrifice to be able to get my foot into the door. I'm not going to get my dream home on my first try. Maybe I get a studio. Maybe I buy a duplex with a friend. Maybe I buy a triplex with a couple of friends. You need to look at your alternatives and be willing to sacrifice. Maybe I'm not going to get a parking spot. Maybe I'm going to have to get a Murphy bed. Like, you're not going to get your dream home, and that's okay. As long as you get your foot in the door, that's where you start. So I think that's a really big thing that we need to focus on.
For a lot of first-time buyers, that foot in the door can be a condo, as you said. And the condo market is finally seeing some life with a year-over-year increase in sales. So where does the market go from here? We can start with Brad, and then we can move on to Brian.
So I have good news. We host free first-time buyer condo seminars at my office that I host, that I do. And we can cut through all of the pain and lies and the other things that were just spoken about in the real estate industry. We also offer a free investor condominium seminars to show people how they can get in the market and enrich themselves over a long period of time. I have good news. The first bit of good news is today is the best time going forward forever to buy a home. Today is the best time. Tomorrow is worse than today, but today is the best time. And the reason for that is we've gone through a correction in the real estate market that's been based largely on interest rate policy. In fact, I'd say pretty well entirely on that. And that is, as Ben has said, is likely to change going forward for the better for people. And right now, the way most consumers are feeling, according to our sense of things, is that the fact that rates have stayed stable for 5 or 6 months makes people feel comfortable that they can make a decision and not fear the future. So every day going forward from here will be a more positive day for real estate. So that's the good news. The bad news is it means prices will go higher and higher and higher. So right now, you can buy a existing condominium in Toronto in a pretty good building for $1,200 a square foot. For me to sell it to you brand new, I need $1,600 a foot. That spread of $400 a foot, about 150 to 200 of it, is what's happened to the market over the last 2 years. So take advantage of that because it's going away. Because I can't build anything until that price goes from 1,200 to 1,400 because we need to sell for 1,600. But a consumer will pay $1,400 for something that's delivered in 4 or 5 years. So the problem right now is that builders aren't building anymore. It's a very serious problem. So we finished our last building. So we put our last building in the ground in the summer. We sold it in February 2022. We have four towers we're building right now. We haven't really sold anything in our new projects for 2 years and a month. And that means that we're 2 years and a month behind building our next building. And every single developer in the city is in exactly the same place. Last year, 13,000 new condominiums sold in the city. In a typical year, we sell, and when I say the city, it's the GTA. Typically, we want to see around 25 to 30,000 new condos sold. Now, you think, well, that's not so bad. Those 13,000 condos will get built, but they won't get built. Because what happened is all the developers have sold 30 or 40% of their projects, and they can't get started. Because you can't get started unless you've sold 70% of your building. And every developer is the same way. There are some very well-heeled developers that will risk $300 or $400 million of their cash to get started and then worry about financing it later. But there's a handful of those. Pretty well every other developer in the city needs to sell first. What we do is we sell 70%. That is called that amount of sales gives us a self-liquidating loan that allows us to borrow 75% of the cost of the building. The rest is our equity, purchasers' deposits, and some profit. That's how the system works. So what you're going to see is that the last crane went in the ground sometime around September, October. Now, it's different for purpose built rental. I'm talking about the condominium market. So we have a shortage coming up in about 3 years. We already have a shortage now. We're going to have a worse shortage in about 3 years because of this interest rate policy. And what do shortages do? They make prices go higher. The other problem we have in our development industry is that inflation has been about 20% overall in the last 3 years, and that's also inflated the cost of building. It affects everything, right? So concrete prices are higher. Tradesmen got a 6% increase in 1 year alone. So now our problem is that if we want to bring a building to market, we have that issue with higher prices. But prices will fall. Construction prices will fall because no one will be going into ground in the next 2 or 3 years, as I said, because no one's sold enough to do that. So prices will fall for construction. And then trades will start to lay people off. They'll shrink their imprint because they don't have enough business to keep all the people. Then what will happen is this year and next year, we'll start selling lots of condos again. And we'll go back to the trades and say, now we've got a record year of sales. We need you to build these. They can say, well, we shrunk the business. We don't have enough people anymore. So there'll be competition for materials and trades, which will cause prices to rise. So the problem with all of this interest rate stuff is it's just going to punish the consumer badly. So I think that right now, my number is $1,600 a foot. That's what I need today. In 2 years, I'm going to need $1,800 a foot. $1,800 a foot. So I'm like every other developer in the city. We all work on the same numbers. We all buy land for roughly the same price. We all put in the same appliances and use a certain number of architects. Our prices aren't that much different in terms of our cost and our selling prices. So what we're in for is I think some pain, and I don't really know what can be done to protect a consumer from this. I don't think there's enough money in the Treasury. I don't think there's enough money in Canada to solve the problem. All the condos we need to build, at the rate we have to build them, we're just not going to be able to do it. And I'm the bearer of bad news again, but I just think what it means for all of you is higher prices. So if you're looking to buy today, best day ever.
Thanks, Brad.
Brian.
Brian, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was listening to the radio this morning and they said we need 3 million more homes in Canada by 2030. It will probably take us 60 years to build 3 million new homes. It's not possible. It's not. Benjamin, you're going to...
Actually, the number is updated now. It's 5 million.
5 million. So that's 100 years. And they want it in 6 years. And as Brad knows, it takes 6 years to get your project approved. So I don't know where this is coming from, but real estate is always a fantastic investment. We've all bought property over the years. It's always gone up. We've always said, I can't believe it can't go any higher, and it keeps going higher. So it is always a great investment, but affordability is not possible. I mean, we talk about building. If I hear one more time someone say, well, we're going to build more because we're going to make it more affordable, it's not possible. The land is too expensive. The cost to build is too expensive. They're building houses so far out of the city that are still $1,400 a foot and $1,500 a foot. It's not that much cheaper to move out of the city, and you can't dumb the buildings down anymore. You can't strip any of the finishes. The finishes aren't that great in the first place. I mean, you look at what's being built. What, you know, all the money goes into a common area and the suite has nothing in it. So when you're looking at 500 square feet at $800,000 or $900,000, and it's not going to get any cheaper, how is that going to be affordable for someone making $70,000 or $80,000 a year when the city is raising the real estate taxes and the mortgage rates are going up? I don't see how it's ever going to happen. And you can build as much as you want. And someone says, well, you'll build a lot and prices will come down. 5 million houses you have to build for the prices to come down. It's not going to happen. So I don't know what the solution is. But when we talk about rentals, and everybody mentions condos and rentals, which we'll get into, that is not stable housing. So we'll talk about that.
Does anybody else want to chime in?
Yeah, actually, I have a question for Brad. One thing I've really struggled with pre-construction is how to justify the, I think you said $400 gap that you need, what you need to sell it for versus what the current resale price is trading at. So how is it that you, with your, you know, target demographic or your target buyers, how are you able to justify that? And where are you kind of seeing people being able to forego buying something cheaper today than buying something more expensive that they'll get in 6 years?
Well, it's unjustifiable. We can't justify it, and that's why they're not selling. That's why, as I said, 13,000 condos sold last year, spread over, you know, hundreds of projects, and nobody achieved even close to the numbers to start building. So they're all offering, you know, discounts on parking, you know, rent guarantees, Rolls Royces in buildings to drive you around to your appointments. It's not justifiable. What is justifiable, and we've seen this for the last eight or nine years, it used to be a smaller gap when prices were lower. What is justifiable is about a $200 gap. And over 5 years, you can expect prices to rise 5 to 6%. And that means that by the time you close on your brand new condo, it's worth what you paid for it or a little bit more. But more importantly, what's great about buying a new condo is that if you don't have the ability to put up $100,000 right away, what we do in the development industry is we give you time to put your deposits down, right? So if you buy a condominium for $700,000 and you need a $100,000 deposit, we'll give you 2 or 3 years to put the money down in 15 or so tranches so you can get there. So it's kind of a forced savings program that gets you into the business or into home ownership in 5 years as opposed to instantaneously in today's market. But you can't justify $400 a foot, and that's why there's no new cranes going up.
Shall we move on to detached homes? All right. So the market for detached homes has been moving in fits and starts, with many potential buyers waiting on the sidelines for interest rates to drop. Remember June? When will demand return, and what will that mean for the market? Michael and then Sebastian, go ahead.
Thank you. That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to focus my comments on single-family detached homes. And to bring context to it, a single-family detached home in central Toronto right now averages at $2.5 million. And further context, there's 147 sales all of last month, which makes up 2.6% of the entire market. So I've got some bad news, and then I've got some temporary good news. The bad news is, if you think pricing in Toronto is high now, watch out. In the next 2 to 3 years, pricing is going to be through the roof on single-family detached homes. So one thing to think about when we're talking about the timing of an interest rate drop, if it happens in June, so right now we're in March, if you think about it for a moment, the first drop, they're not going to drop it by 150 basis points. They'll probably drop it by a quarter point. That's going to force people to flood the market. The confidence is going to come back. The exuberance is going to come back, and that's going to drive pricing up. And when I talk about the 147 sales, the reasons why there's so few is because there's no product. There's no availability. There's no selection. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. The most important point is the opportunity. Brad said it very well. The opportunity is right now. You know, people are thinking to themselves, okay, well, I'll wait till June and we'll get a quarter point reduction in the overnight rates, and that will equate to a slightly lower mortgage rate. But if you think about what's going to happen to demand and price appreciation, it's better to buy today if you can afford it than waiting, because by the time you wait, the slight decrease in your mortgage rate is not going to make up for the incredibly improved pricing of those same homes. And I'll pass.
Okay, so I'm not the brass tacks stats guy. I'm just a carpenter. So as far as demand for detached homes, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of demand for detached homes right now, but I do know that there's a lot of desire. There's a lot of people in this city who really do want to live in an area that has more space and a proper home to raise their family in. From what I read today, you know, in Toronto, which is an extremely densely populated city, for every square kilometer, there's 4,000 occupants. That's like 1,000 meters squared, 4,000 occupants. That is a staggering number to me. I live right in the downtown core, so I feel it every single day when I walk my dog. There's so many people. It's very dense. And I think that what we know about that is not necessarily the best for mental health. It's not necessarily the best for medical health, as we just found out from COVID, being packed in so tightly together. And I would imagine that, like myself, many people in Toronto do have a strong desire for detached homes. It just doesn't correlate with the cost of living and the cost of those homes. And so we have an opportunity to change desire into demand if we are creating the right kind of homes in the right kind of places. It was a common thought years ago that you would become a home buyer or home owner if you lived in Toronto and you rented in Toronto at a reasonable rate. You could save up money, and then you probably wouldn't be able to buy inside Toronto because it's very expensive. So you'd move to the outskirts somewhere, Vaughan, Markham, East Gwillimbury, any of these kind of places, and get a cheaper house with a little bit of space, a backyard for your dog and your kids. But the prices of the homes that we're building out in those neighborhoods are staggering as well. There's no significant decrease in the price if you move outside of the city as to whether you stay inside the city. So there's no escape for people who are thinking there's nowhere necessarily to go and no reason to go out to those particular places. It makes more sense to stay inside the city because this is where all of the amenities are. So we have like a high demand for living spaces or high desire for living spaces, but we have a low demand on the actual properties that are there because they're just not affordable. I don't think that means that we should give up on the dream of you know, being homeowners or detached homeowners. I just think that maybe it means that we need to change up the dream a little bit. I think everyone up here on this panel is basically said like it's terrible. Maybe there's a silver lining and we don't know what to do. So in my opinion, as a designer and a builder, that means that it's time to ideate and think about how we go about reimagining the cities that we're living in and perhaps building in a different way. Currently we build, outside of the city, these huge swaths of like really expensive kind of suburban sprawl. There's no real access to transit to get in and out of the city where all of the amenities are. There's no quick access to medical and convenience stores, commercial properties, social spaces. All those, they all look relatively the same. Very low walkability score. Very expensive, not very desirable. Maybe we need to be thinking about how we're building outside of the city of Toronto and make those spaces more comfortable so that people can go out there and don't need to commute into the city so much. We are building houses out. We are building a lot of houses, not a lot, not enough, those houses outside the city, but they're still very expensive. Too expensive for anyone who's in the city to afford. So, like, who are we building those houses for if people can't afford them, right? Are we just building them for, like, these investment pool people that, put their money together and buy these houses? Are we just buying them for companies that they can purchase these homes and then rent them back to people forever? I don't think that's how I want to live. I don't think it's how a lot of people want to live. And so I think there's a reimagination that's necessary. I would say that, yes, there's desire for detached homes, but I don't think that it's currently affordable, and that we need to re-envision how we're building these city centers and create new city centers that have access to the things that they need to make these spaces more desirable for people. How it's done, I'm just dreaming. These guys know, they're all looking at me like I'm crazy. Like I said, I'm not the stats guy. I don't know how the math does. I'm good with the Pythagoras theorem. I'll square up your walls. I'll build you a beautiful arch. I don't do the heavy algebra that Barry and these guys do. But what I do know is that we have to take a moment here to assess how we're building and make sure that we're building the correct thing for the future generations and not just give up on our dreams, but man, have a new dream.
Jennifer, do you want to follow up on that?
Go ahead, yeah. Clap, man. Go for it. If nothing else, it was passionate.
I mean, city planning is your thing, so.
Well, that's an awesome leaping off point. On Monday, the National Task Force for Housing and Climate released its report. Some of you may have seen this. You can Google the report. It's called Building More Homes Better. And it actually it actually connects into a lot of the themes that you were just talking about here. This was a 15-member task force from across the country. Full disclosure, I was one of the task force members, and we identified a series of key pillars for how we both meet our, it's actually 5.8 million homes in terms of the deficit that we face given our immigrants, which is just, you know, yes. We would have to build four times more homes than we've ever built in our peak building period. And our peak building period was back in the 1970s, just to put that in context. So we're very far away from meeting that objective. But one of the critical and key foundational recommendations in the report is that where we build homes is essential to both building more affordably, to increasing quality of life, and also to meeting our climate objectives. Hopefully there's some people in the room here who care about climate change. The report puts a really big emphasis on how we actually build in a way that's sustainable. And, you know, not building in floodplains is a really good starting point. We're still building homes in floodplains, and then the federal government is bailing out municipalities when those homes flood. So as a starting point, let's not build in floodplains. But the key part of where we build is a focus on recognizing that over the course of the past 10 years, 75% of all new homes have been built in new communities, in greenfields, in places where we don't have water, we don't have roads, we don't have schools, we don't have transit. So we have to build out all of that infrastructure, which, believe it or not, makes building the home very, very expensive. There's no road, there's no water, there's no electricity. So the emphasis in the report is that we need to dream a better dream, and it's a little bit different from what you've articulated, which is we need to get better at infill development and building up where we already have infrastructure. And here's where you and I diverge. We don't diverge often, Sebastian, but here's where we diverge. Toronto is not a dense city. The vast majority of Toronto has been losing density in 80% of the land area. I didn't make that number up. In 80% of the land area in Toronto, we have been losing density over the course of the past 15 years. Families are becoming smaller in our suburban areas. Homes are becoming bigger. That's losing density. It's why we have many schools in the city right now that are not even at 50% capacity in the city. So just think about that for a minute. In greenfield developments in the suburbs, we're building brand new schools. But in the city, we have schools where the doors are locked down the hallway because there's no kids to fill the classrooms. So a really big part of where we build and building back better and building in a sustainable way is building in areas where we already have infrastructure. And it does mean a different dream in terms of thinking about housing in a fundamentally different way, thinking about housing options, thinking about fourplexes, thinking about six-story buildings, thinking about a diversity of housing types, which you find in most great cities of the world, building out mid-rise. And by the way, in my company, we're building all of these types. We're building five-story buildings. We're building eight-story buildings. We've got a 29-story tower within a kilometer of here that's coming out of the ground under construction. We're building all of these different types. Yes, it's tricky to do it. The math is tricky, but a really critical part of making the math work, particularly in a moment like this, is using land in a different way from how we've used land traditionally. So think about the one-story library. Well, guess what? The municipality can use that site and contribute it to a development. There's no land cost because the municipality owns the land already, and you can build a tower and build housing above. We have one of these projects. It's going to be announced in a couple of months. It's a partnership with the City of Toronto. The Toronto Water had a one-story building within 500 meters of transit, a one-story office building on a site that's in a very urban location. We are rebuilding the office space in the podium of a residential building, and we're building a 34-story tower with new high-quality homes. What's important about this is there's new models that we can embrace. And this moment demands us to think creatively and to dream a new dream about building housing in a new way, because the old model of buying up some greenfield and laying down new roads and new schools, that is a model that on the one hand is problematic because it leads to crazy traffic congestion and very high costs, but it also runs counter to what I think is an emerging dream in the Toronto context of having really high quality, higher order transit, really high quality public spaces. Our challenge right now, in my opinion, that you experience when you're walking your dog, Sebastian, is that we've gone into part of the dream. We're building density, but we haven't been investing in the infrastructure that makes dense urban living really high quality and really wonderful. You know, that those kind of urban places that you like to visit on vacation, like Paris and London and Barcelona, all those places that Torontonians and Canadians go to and say, oh, it's so wonderful. And then we come back home and we're like, man, density sucks. We don't have that density here. We are not as dense as Paris. We're not as dense even remotely as Barcelona or London, which, by the way, are mid-rise cities. Our problem is very much our public infrastructure investments. We've got to link together building high quality walkable places with excellent transit with building a variety of new forms of housing. And I will just say, having a kid who grew up in a single family home at Yonge and Eglinton, my kid has no illusion about owning a single family home. And she's a young professional. She just wants to live in a great neighborhood where she can walk everywhere, where she can get on transit to see her friends, where she can raise a family and not have to worry about, you know, getting kicked out because the rent went up. But the illusion, I think the illusion for millennials isn't about home ownership. It's actually about wanting to be able to figure out a way to stay in the city. And the way to do it is to think about housing in a very different way.
But you know, we, just on a small scale, we're restoring a heritage building in the city for our offices. And we've been working with Heritage and working with the city. It's taken years to get it to this point, and we're going to move in the end of the year. But one of the questions was where it was a residence, and we changed the zoning. And the Ratepayers Association, that was very supportive of the project, said, would you consider putting a rental suite in the building? I said, well, not in the basement because it's our offices, but there's a garage in the back, and we'll build an apartment. So we got approval for the restoration of the house, and we hired a great architect to design this beautiful apartment that was going to, we promised it would be affordable. We were going to charge about $1,800 a month for a 450 square foot apartment on transit, and we had renderings done, the best consultants, and it would take me probably 30 years to pay it off, but we were turned down. And it was on an existing footprint. There is a heritage coach house behind it, which is almost double the size. It was three bays, and just turned it down. And we said, we're not appealing this. We're not going. We thought, oh, the city, of course, is going to approve this with our new mayor. They're so anxious to have this. We had the support of the neighbors, the immediate neighbors. We had the support of the Ratepayers Association. Even the neighbor adjacent to me said, how did it go? And I said, we were turned down. She said, well, I told my son we're going to do the same thing as Brian when he gets his approval. So we're not even getting the encouragement to build these, even when we promise they'll be affordable, and the city is making it so onerous, but there wasn't even a discussion. It was just not approved. So we're trying.
We're going to quickly move to Bridget and then Benjamin, and then we'll move on.
So in a way, I mean, I think that the city has to change. I think housing is so important, but it's actually an instrumental part of city building. So it's actually not just about housing. I think to Jennifer's point, it's how we build a better city with housing as one of the pieces of our toolkit. And I really appreciated Sebastian's comment about how do we reimagine the city that we already have? If you in your mind's eye, a map of the zoning for the city of Toronto is kind of scary because it actually allows you to build super high buildings at certain transit intersections along the waterfront and certain key areas, and everything else is shrink wrapped. It's called the Yellow Belt. It's all of our residential neighborhoods. And so if a visitor comes to Toronto, what you'll hear is, oh, Toronto, it's so great. It has such wonderful neighborhoods. So all of the kind of zoning bylaws over the last several decades have supported the kind of shrink wrapping of these neighborhoods. And that I think they have really prevented any kind of development from happening in these residential zones. So your project is a perfect example of that. I've been an advocate of laneway housing for the last 25 years. I live in a house in a back alley. It used to be a bunch of derelict cars, but we had to go up against the Ontario Municipal Board at the time to build a 1,350 square foot house. And it was a real David and Goliath story. But in 2018, with a lot of work from a lot of people, Laneway Housing is now in as of right condition. You can go and go for a building permit if you meet certain requirements. And what I've seen over the last few years is a really interesting phenomena, because all of the development that everyone else is talking about is really top down, requires banks and developers and assembling large parcels of land. What's so interesting for me about Laneway Housing is that they're actually average people who want choices. They want a place for an elder parent or a workspace in their backyard as a studio, or for a teenage kid to live, or any number of scenarios that allows you to have flexibility in your single family house over time. And I feel like what we need as citizens is choice. And we have very few choices. You can buy the $2.5 million house in a single family residential neighborhood, or a condo that Brad will sell you really easily. But there's very little in between. And there isn't a finer grain fabric that accommodates your needs as a over your time period on this earth. Your needs change. You need spaces for your kids, and your parents get older, and you have so many changing needs over time. And in a way, so Laneway Housing, garden suites are not the answer. When they're presented as affordable, they're not quite affordable. But what I'm seeing, which is so interesting, is that it is a bottom-up movement. It actually is regular people actually having a level of empowerment over a degree of flexibility that's happening through all residential neighborhoods in the city, that is actually kind of interesting, because it's the first time that I've seen something that is more bottom-up than top-down. And it just allows people choice and ability to adjust to their life changes. And for someone like Jane Jacobs, what you want to do is live in a village within a metropolis. You want to support all the infrastructure that Jennifer's talking about, the schools, the transit, the services, and you want to support those services and strengthen them, as opposed to eating up, you know, greenfield lands on the outskirts and having to drive an hour and a half. I teach at the University of Toronto in the Faculty of Architecture, Landscape, and Design. I polled my students, and 80% of them spend an hour and a half on transit. They have to live in a suburban area because they can't afford to be in the downtown. They have to get on two or three modes of transit to get to One Spadina Avenue, and then they have to get back home. And we're trying to create a studio culture in the building, but it's really hard when they have to commute an hour and a half in each direction. So I guess I'm an advocate for choice, and for the choice being of the average citizen having a little bit of control to be able to at least make a difference in their lives and create equity at the same time. And I feel like we're at the beginning of that. So all things like Laneway Housing, garden suites are in their infancy stage, but the fact that they even exist, I think, is a very positive step forward. I think, like Jennifer was saying, we have to redefine what density is. And we are nowhere near dense. When we think about Toronto relative to global cities, we are so not dense and so low rise, except in these designated transit nodes where you can build, you know, a 90-story tower at the foot of Yonge and the lakeshore. So there you're allowed to be super high. And then there are residential neighborhoods where there's no change that's happened for decades. So we have to redefine and recalibrate where density goes, and that we can. And part of it is wanting to make great cities as opposed to just adding houses. So the kind of issues of the quality of public spaces, parks, and kind of schools and cultural facilities are about making a better city, and housing is an integral part of that vision. So we need a new vision.
Yeah.
I love that.
You're here. Benjamin, you can.
Very, very, very briefly, a few months ago, I had an opportunity to present to the cabinet on housing affordability. And I told them, my first sentence was, listen, if we don't deal with it urgently, we are going to have pockets of civil unrest.
We are going to have anti-immigrant sentiments. We are going to have rental strikes. It's written. I can see the trajectory. We have to wake up. So we have two options. This is a crisis. Do nothing. And looking at the faces of especially young people here, this is not an option. We cannot give up. It's not going to be easy, but we can do things. This is a crisis that requires attention immediately. And I believe we can do that in many, many ways. The missing middle clearly is a factor. We have to provide different ways of looking at the thing. I totally agree with the other people that mentioned here. Factory-made houses. I think that's something that we have to think about because other people in other countries are doing it. We cannot build the way we built 50 years ago. So we have many ways of doing it. We cannot simply give up. We have to continue providing solutions to young people here, and a rental solution will be a big part of it. Purpose-built rental will be a big part of the solution, and I believe that more incentives to developers to build purpose-built is the right thing to do. I think we can do it. It will not be perfect. Toronto will not be affordable anytime soon, but it can be easier because at this point, we are basically running faster to stay in the same place. And the easiest thing to do is to deal also with demand. We have a situation. This is not new immigrants. New immigrants, the quota is 550, 600. What we need to do with new immigrants is to change the point system. Only 2% of new immigrants are in construction. And we know that we have shortage. So we have a situation in which we can raise the change the point system to get more construction workers trades among new immigrants. So instead of the problem, they are the solution. That's one thing. We have 1.2 million foreign students in this country. Many of them are not students. No, they're not. 20-25% of them are not going to school at all. This is not a joke. And there are all those Mickey Mouse colleges. You know, the Northern Toronto Academy of Advanced Mathematics. Like, give me a break. It doesn't exist. But you pay $40,000 tuition. Why? Because you are buying Canadian citizenship on a cheap. Many of those poor foreign students are on food banks. They don't have a place to live. And they compete in the rental market. Cut the number, put quotas. It's impossible to imagine a situation in which universities and colleges, especially colleges, don't have a quota. They can basically decide as many as they want. The system is being taken advantage of. So first of all, easy, from today to tomorrow, you put quotas, I was supporting it. We need more than that. Cut the demand, especially from foreign students. And then turn those foreign students into new immigrants. So you get educated people. So instead of having 500 new immigrants and then 1.2 foreign students, part of the 500 will be foreign students. This way you reduce demand because we simply don't have the supply. You cannot have so many foreign students and not able to house them. It's not fair to them and to us. So let's cut the demand, that's easy, and then deal with the supply, and it can be done. Toronto will not be affordable, but we can move in the right direction if we choose to do so.
Thanks, Benjamin.
I have a very quick solution to being able to deliver practical, affordable high-rise housing. And so I told you all that the cost of delivering a building in Toronto I didn't say that, actually. I said it was $1,600 was the price we need. But our cost is $1,200 plus taxes, okay? So if we can get that number from $1,200 to $800, then we can build lots of high-rise housing. $800 a foot is the number because we get about $400 or $450 a foot for rent. Okay, so not to bamboozle you with math, but basically real estate investors want a 5% return, a 5 cap rate. So you just take the rent, divide by the price of the property, and that's what someone will pay for it. So how do we get that down to that number? So in my world, 25% to 30% of my costs are government taxes. So we're doing a building in Mississauga. It's a $320 million building and $80 million to $88 million. Depends on when we start it because every year the taxes go up with the cities. So over a quarter of that, $88, $90 million, imagine that, is going to taxes, HST and levies. In Mississauga, a studio pays close to $70,000. For the privilege of building a studio, in a place where there's already lots of electricity and transit and sewer and water, you have to pay as a consumer, because you pay us and we pay the city, $70,000. Then on top of that, there's community benefit charges. There's parks levies. There's just a host of bullshit charges that you're paying as a consumer. So, and developers of high-rise buildings that are rental also have to ultimately pay those too. If we can get rid of all of those taxes, because at the end of the day, through your rent, you're paying property taxes. The developer or the owner of the building is going to collect the taxes and pay them to the city, right? So what we need to do is have this stuff go away for 10 years. And we need to have the federal government, if this big of a, I think this is the single biggest issue for voting right now. I think people are very concerned about affordable housing. And really nothing is being done, really nothing. The federal government is talking about it, but nothing's happening, I promise you. Nothing's going to change, nothing's happening, unless serious things happen like this. So we need low interest loans. And, you know, you can do that by saying to a developer, we'll loan you money at 2%. But you have to guarantee this building is a rental for 50 years, right? So guarantee tenancy to people for 50 years. After that, the builder can do what he wants. But this is the kind of stuff we have to do, but they're not doing it. And until this happens, I promise you, you can run the numbers 1,000 ways. We will not solve our affordable housing problem.
Jennifer wants to chime in, and I wonder if I could throw something out based on what Benjamin said as well, because truly it's something I'm curious about. Where do we look at prefab houses, 3D printed houses, tiny homes? Does that fit in as well? Jennifer, you wanted to say something.
So two things. I can speak to that as well. Just to put a fine point on what Brad's saying, I think this would be surprising to most people to realize, but in the city of Toronto, when you buy a new home, there's a development charge that has been charged by the city that was charged to the developer that gets passed on to the purchaser for a whole variety of things that are sort of completely unrelated to the house that was just built. So, for example, we have subsidized daycare spaces in the city of Toronto. When you buy a new home, you get charged a little bit of money that goes into the pot for subsidized daycare spaces. You get charged a little bit of money for libraries. You get charged a little bit of money for enhancing the TTC. Now, remember, when you move into that unit and you're paying your taxes every year, you're also paying for all of those things. So it's like we're putting a little surcharge on new homeowners coming into the city. It's a surcharge that is increasing the cost of that housing. And it raises an interesting question. Should newcomers be the one bearing a little bit of extra cost, which when you add it all together becomes a lot of extra cost, between 23 and 26% of the cost of building a new home are government charges. So if you think about something that can be done very quickly to moderate the high cost of building new housing, that's something that's completely within the government's control, right? The government can, through the stroke of a pen, say, you know what, we're going to stop putting the burden of infrastructure on new people coming into the housing market. Instead, we're going to create an infrastructure fund, right? The provincial government could create an infrastructure fund and just wipe out development charges altogether. I would argue that would be a much better way to fund infrastructure than putting specific costs on new homeowners. So just to put a fine point on that. With respect to factory and modular housing.
Jennifer, I'm so sorry to jump in. We do have to move on to our audience questions. Sorry about that. Our first audience question is actually for you, and it says, what are the top 5 strategies and secrets when doing land development? Maybe top one.
Top one strategy? Well, in 2024, the top strategy is a partnership with someone who has access to land. That's the top strategy for 2024, because if you pay market value for land, you're going to have a very hard time making the pro forma work. And most projects that aren't working right now that developers have shelved, they generally have a high land cost associated with them. It's very, very tricky to make anything work if the land was purchased any time in the past 4 years. Those projects are all on ice. So figuring out a way to access land. And look, we get land in all kinds of crazy ways, including people who have a family home in, you know, we had someone recently as a family home in the annex. It's in a great location. The site is large enough because it has some parking where you can pop a tower on the site. That's a really good partnership because we don't have to buy the land at market value. We can vend the land into the deal and we can create a viable development project. So figuring out, you know, development always starts with land. So figuring out, that's the number one strategy, figuring out how to approach land and partner around land or use land that you might have in your portfolio in some way. That is the number one first strategy. I'd love to give the next four, but we'll save that for another day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Another question from the audience, and this is for any of the developers. Downtown office usage is still only at about 50%. So is redeveloping commercial to residential realistic in this city?
No.
Not really.
Not at all.
Thank you, Brad.
Sorry.
I'd like to add something to that.
Sorry, just one quick thing. So floor plans, I was sort of getting. Floor plans for office buildings are 20, 30, 40,000 square feet. They're very deep and very large. What happens if you put a quarter down the middle of it, you have a football field for an apartment. So you need small floor plates of 6, 7, 8,000 square feet. And those office buildings can be converted, but they typically are older buildings and there's very few of them left in the city.
Michael, sorry.
Yeah, just quickly. I was just reading a report from Goldman Sachs saying that the price of office buildings have to come down 50% to make them a viable alternative. And I think that's very important to think about. People are so quick to look at Class B and C towers and say, oh, it's perfect. We'll just convert them into residential. But it's just not viable at the prices that they are. It's to Jennifer's point about the cost of land, cost of property.
Brad and I were talking about a project that I worked on at the time was the, I think it still is, the largest conversion in the world of a building from commercial to residential. It was actually industrial, which was the Sears warehouse at the Ryerson campus. And they were very challenging suites to design because that was a massive floor plate, bigger than any office tower, because they had trains that drove into the building, like trucks would come in the elevators. And that was a very challenging, very creative process. But it is possible, but it has to be cheap. And that building, no one wanted it. It was more expensive to demolish the building than it was to buy the building. But we were able to do it as 1 million square feet of residential in that building.
I almost bought one of those.
You should have.
Did it.
You went up a lot.
I kick myself daily. Don't doubt it. All right, we're going to move on once again. Next question. Both the Bank of Canada and the Prime Minister have recently called out investors for driving up home prices. We've been touching on this a bit. Bridget and then Jennifer, is this really the root of the city's affordability problems?
You can go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Bridget.
Sorry, you were saying the
investors, do you want me to start?
Sure, yeah.
So the question of whether investors are at the root of the affordability crisis, it's a very strange take, I think, on the problem. I think there's a whole variety of ways that we've mismanaged our overall stock of housing in our housing economy. And there was a period of time when it worked extremely well for people to buy real estate and to rent out that real estate, and the math actually worked as a viable model. That model actually doesn't work very well right now, which is one of the reasons why you see so many condos on the market in downtown Toronto, because it's very difficult with higher interest rates to cover your carrying costs, because your carrying costs are typically higher than rent. So I think, you know, it's a little bit of pointing fingers here and there. We do have a very broken model. It's one of the reasons why purpose-built rental is, I would argue, so critical, because a family can move into purpose-built rental and live there as long as that rental fits their housing needs. And if the family gets smaller because children move out, they can move into another rental unit. So I think it's I would strongly disagree with that suggestion.
But I do think that rental does not currently in Toronto have the range of choice that people need. So in a way, Jennifer, you're talking about rental at different stages of your life. And I would say in a European context, people are much more comfortable and are used to renting. And the variety and the amazing array of rental units available in most European cities
is where you could live as a family, you could live as a person, a young person, an older person, and it's actually very much accommodates a range of possibilities. Here it's, you know, the kind of the choices I feel again are so limited and really driven by a condo market as opposed to a kind of rental is your home concept, which I think we have to shift our thinking within Toronto and within North America.
Mm-hmm. We're just going to move on to our, go ahead.
I just want to raise something about maybe it is the elephant in the room or it isn't, but I hear the developers talk about interest rates and buyers can't buy because rates are so high and developers are holding back on sites because interest rates are so high. And Benjamin says rates are going to come down and the world be great again. But my question is, you know, this notion about Canada being the little sister, more directed to Benjamin, Canada being the little sister to the U.S., that their rates haven't come down. They just talked about their GDP going through the roof. And it's not likely that we're going to make a rate change if they don't make a rate change. And if they don't need to make a rate change, what happens if Canada doesn't? Or is Canada the little sister that everybody talks about?
Yeah, that's a very good question. To what extent we are... We can divorce ourselves from the U.S. The short answer, we can do it at least for 50 basis points, because usually the gap between the Bank of Canada and the Fed is about 75 basis points, 100 basis points. Now the gap is 25 basis points. So it's either the Fed is undershooting or the Bank of Canada is overshooting. And I don't think that the Fed is undershooting. I think the Bank of Canada is overshooting. So I know that the Bank of Canada can go independently of the Fed for 50 basis points, and then we'll have to wait for the Fed. So I think the Fed will go after the Bank of Canada because their economy is doing okay, but it's starting to slow down. So the Bank of Canada has some room to maneuver in terms of being independent from the...
But do you think 50 basis points will change the world?
No, but then the Fed will start cutting and then we follow. But the Fed eventually will cut, yeah.
But it's interesting, in the United States, the president mentioned, was it yesterday, that America needs, I don't know, Benjamin can tell me, 2 million houses built in the same period that we need over five. They have eight times the population. I don't know what they're doing.
Much slower immigration.
The immigration ratio between Canada and the U.S. is 1 to 6. Yes, 1 to 6. So we get six times more than the U.S. And that's without counting non-permanent residents and students. So if you look at population growth in Canada, it's a hockey stick. No other OECD country is even close to that. So something is wrong with this picture.
That's exactly the number.
Yeah.
If you multiplied it by six, yeah, they'd be in the same position.
We did want to quickly move on to our home reno section with Brian and Sebastian. So we can see that inflation has driven up not just mortgage rates, but also construction and material costs. And now inflation, as Benjamin said, is coming down. So are you seeing that follow through to construction and home renovation costs? And are those prices actually dropping?
No.
Okay.
No, but we're seeing many more buyers or potential buyers getting out of the market and saying, we will change the house we live in. So we're looking at that they were, at one point, they were looking to move up or move down. And now they're saying the gap is so big. You know, even if you're downsizing, the gap is big for many people. So it's more expensive to leave your house and buy a condo. So we're seeing a lot more people that are saying we are going to change the house. And then you're looking at people that are making multifamily homes within their family. So they're moving their parents into the house or they're moving their children into the house. And they may be moving into the garden suite and giving the house to their children. So we're seeing some interesting changes happening to the way people are looking at the existing house they have and saying, we're not looking at what's happening in the market. And if they have the two families living in there, that helps subsidize the renovations.
What about you, Sebastian?
Yeah, there have been... there's a lot of issues in the renovation space right now. I think that... That's a definite trend that we're seeing. You know, when I started on this panel 5 years ago, I think the first thing I said, probably to my chagrin, because everyone stared at me, was, flipping. I wasn't in agreement with flipping houses and just, you know, buying up the stock and then flipping it for return on investment and not caring about who's coming in after. I think that it is a portion of why we're in the situation that we're in right now. Of course, not the whole thing. That trend died off when the housing stock got so expensive. And then the renovation scene really kind of changed to people building income properties. And that became a big thing for a couple of years. That's become more of a gamble now because we have a renter class that's so upset with being overcharged that that we're seeing issues with income properties and people are less willing to, from what I'm seeing, you know, we've had an ability to build laneway houses, garage suites, put fourplexes on residential lots for years now. And we're not seeing huge uptake in that because it's a major risk. First of all, it's a major investment. Second of all, who wants to risk renting one of those places out when the market is as it is and renters are upset, know that they can withhold their rent? The tribunal to handle the discourse between renters and the homeowners takes 9 months, a year and a half even. If that's a situation where you're renting out an income suite in the bottom of your house and someone is not paying the rent, we're going to see people losing their homes over these things. We're talking about small investors, not big time property developers. We're talking about mom and pops investors, which are very important. There's no protection for them right now, which means that there's no interest in building those kind of income suites, income properties. But definitely what we are seeing is the move to multi-generational housing. So now we're still kind of trying to build converting garages, third stories, underpinning building basement suites to protect our extended family from a situation of where the cost of living is so difficult. And lastly, what I'll just quickly say about the renovation industry as a whole is that we have 700,000 builders retiring in the next 5 to 10 years. A huge swath of our builders are retiring, and we don't have enough people replacing them coming in. And so where we need innovation within the renovation industry is with getting new people into the trades. We need to embrace different types of programs to get people trained up in remote areas so that we can do the type of building that we need. If we are bringing in so many immigrants, you know, 1-to-6 ratio, then maybe 100,000 of those should be carpenters. And that might help us out a little bit with some of our problems.
It's true. That's one of the biggest problems we have.
Thank you.
Is that, you know, I don't know who's more important to you, your plumber or your doctor, because people are like begging to get trades and the costs have become so over the top. We see these prices come across our desks every day and every year we're in shock at how much it costs to renovate, but you can't get the trades. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
We're going to move on to everyone's favorite part of the night, which is our crystal ball predictions. But before we go to that, we wanted to pull up one of the most accurate predictions from our 2023 panel. So Brad told us in March of last year, quote, "We have another 9 months of this nonsense with interest rates. It'll pass. There will be minimal damage to the real estate market as there has been this year." So with the bar set high, let's get your predictions for this year. And Michael, we can start with you.
My predictions are a little bit longer than short term. They're medium and long term predictions, and I'm incredibly bullish on the market. I think it's, you know, I think we all, if we look into the crystal ball, we all see what the story is. The rates are going to come down. All these people have been sitting on the sidelines. These buyers are going to rush back into the market. There's very little supply on the resale, and as Brad said, on the new home sales side. It's going to drive the prices up and the prices are going to go up exorbitantly. And people are going to be going, we're going to be telling the same story that we told 2 and 3 years ago. There's nothing available to buy. And I honestly believe too, and Brad may disagree, that all of this supply of all of the condo supply that we're talking about now that's sitting stagnant, that's all going to be eaten up within the next probably year to year and a half, maybe 2 years. And I'll pass.
Anya, go ahead.
This ties into a little bit of what Michael was talking about earlier. We talked about detached homes, but we didn't really talk about your average starter home, your Leslieville semi, your 25-foot house in Midtown. Those are already seeing a massive surge in demand. There are houses that are getting 20 offers, 30 offers. We're seeing like some of the same trends that we saw in late 2021, early 2022, where people are blowing comps completely out of the water. They are disregarding recent sales, and they are doing anything and everything that they can to get the house because the speculation of rates dropping in, whether it's June, before or after, is already there. People want to beat the rush. So unless there is a massive shift, fundamental shift in what's going on over the next few months, a huge dump of supply, for instance, I can't imagine that that momentum will slow down.
Brad, go ahead.
So generally speaking, prices have dropped about 10 to 15% from the early spring of 2022. So if Ben's right and they start reducing rates in June and we get a 2% decrease in rates over the next year or so, this time next year, we will have recovered all of that and we'll probably be about 4 or 5% over what the prices were back then. Going forward, I don't really see what can change the inevitable. I think Toronto in Canada is a very desirable country to live in. We are expensive. We are not the most expensive in the world. We may someday be the most expensive in the world because we are probably one of the best cities and countries in the world to live in. I think there's going to have to be solutions about how to solve those problems. But price-wise, and looking at the crystal ball, prices will rise as soon as interest rates start to fall.
Yeah, I think that the spring will be decent. I think the fall will be strong. I think that with interest rates going down, the market will wake up. I think the pioneer of the recovery will be low rise. I think high rise will have to wait to clear the inventories. And I totally agree that 2 years from now, high rise will be on fire because we simply won't have supply. So that's the way I see the situation unfolding.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
So with respect to the market, I think you're going to see more developers trying to figure out how to get into the purpose-built rental space precisely because it's a way to mitigate the short-term risk of not being able to bring condo product to market. So I think there'll be more conversations about that. I'm very much hoping that we will see more incentives from the federal government to be getting purpose-built rental built. I think we're going to see some very, very big announcements in the next 4 to 6 weeks from the provincial government around changes to the planning approvals process in order to expedite getting land entitled so that the barrier to getting housing built isn't going to be the approvals process. Right now in my inbox, I probably have between 5 and 10 zoned sites a day that are coming across my desk, people who have a site that's zoned that they're trying to offload because they don't want to build it and they don't want to hold on to it and carry it. Hopefully that will slow down, but that's a lot of property right now that's sitting on the market that is already zoned. So zoning isn't the only problem, but it's still a big piece of the puzzle. The federal government also in the next 4 to 6 weeks is going to be making some massive announcements, mostly with respect to figuring out a way to unlock federally owned land, provincially owned lands through incentives and municipally owned lands. And that could move the needle and shift some of the thinking in the industry around the type of product that people are willing to build. And I think that anyone who has high-rise condo product, like we do, as well, because we kind of span the spectrum, are going to continue to wait because it's way too risky to launch anything right now in light of so many projects having launched over the course of the past 12 months that just, to Brad's point, didn't get past 30%, so they're not moving forward.
Sebastian.
I think that, of course, the housing situation as well is going to get a little bit worse. I think we may see people pulling their income properties off the market. I think this cash for keys situation that we're seeing in the city is very scary for mom and pop's investors. It's going to be harder for these small landlords to maintain. I think that's a real issue. I think that the homes, housing starts and home building starts and completions is going to slow down over the next couple of years. Building costs are just way too high. Materials are too high. Supply chain is too high. And we just don't have the builders. So we can want to build all we want. But if we don't have those things in place, then we really can't get it done. I think that with that slowdown comes an opportunity, though. And it may be a small one, but we have to see a silver lining in it. And if we're slowing down on the building, then perhaps that can give us an opportunity to think about the type of communities that we want to be building, so that as we're building these communities, these houses, making sure that they have access to transit and all the amenities that they need, and make sure that we're building the right kind of places that people want to live in and are sustainable. If we can figure those things out, you know, what do they say, like, we're trying to build a bridge while it's, build a plane while it's flying, or build a bridge while it's on fire. Everyone's heart is beating, but if we could take a breath and really city plan forward, it will make sure that the next steps that we do take are the best ones.
Barry?
I think that it's inevitable prices will continue to rise. It just won't stop. You know, when I was in my 20s, I think 11% was our normal. And now we're looking at 5% and 6%. And I think it's really about an adjustment. And if rates don't come down, and I hope Benjamin is right, and I do believe he is, but if they don't come down, there will be an adjustment, because you have other forces like the baby boomers, wealth inheritances, you know, money is passed down to the children. That's a force. Foreigners is a force. Interest rates at 6% ain't so bad, but once you get down to 2.75, oh my gosh, watch out. So I think that Toronto Real Estate Board will probably have about 80,000 in sales. They're predicting 77. And I think prices will go up somewhere between 8% and 10% this year.
Bridget, go ahead.
So my family moved from Kingston, Jamaica to Toronto in 1965. And we've seen this kind of amazing transformation of the city through immigrants. And they have actually built the city that we have. All kinds of ethnic groups across the board, and many of their children are some of the biggest developers in the city. How we address the trades, which was the last item that was brought up, how we train the workers that will build this housing need, it's kind of like a key crisis. So we've been talking about interest rates and a whole lot of things, but the people that will build our city are not the kind of immigrants that came before. They need to know how to work with their hands, but they also need to be able to run a 5-axis CNC machine really well. And they need both those skills at the same time. So we really need apprenticeship programs to train the workers of the next generation that will build our housing. We can't even consider a kind of a prefab unless we have these specialized skills that can actually do this work. And that really needs to be where the effort for provincial, federal, local governments are, because it's so critical to construction, and construction is so critical to housing.
You know, real estate is always an incredible investment. And in Toronto, it is never going to go down. I mean, if it blips down, it's going to go way up. But we have to look at what's the lifestyle you want to have. And I look at friends that live in New York and London and Paris, and they live in modest little rentals in the city. We were talking about this, and they bought beautiful houses in the country. And they're thinking, you think to yourself, you know, there was a pair of doctors that are friends of mine that live in New York, and they have, the apartment is so small. They raised their son in this apartment. And finally, it was like, enough. This apartment is a fortune. What are we doing? And they sold the apartment. They rent a small apartment. They work close to the hospitals. And every Friday, they go to the country with their son, and he rides his bike, and he plays basketball, and they have fun. And it's really, what is the life you want to have? You know, I think to myself, there's nothing wrong with living in a 450 or 500 square foot apartment at $1 million. Is it the lifestyle you want for the rest of your life? So think about the way you want to live. But when it comes also to affordability and the prices of Toronto, I don't know if I said it last year, but my parents went through the same thing. And they told me that when they were sitting around a table when they were young, and they all had houses, their first houses or their second houses, one couple bought a house, and they all said, the couple wasn't there, they'll never get their money back. They're crazy. Who spends that on a house? And it's old. It's in Forest. It's an old house. The house was $90,000. It just sold for $9 million. But my parents would say, we would laugh. We would say, they're never going to get their money back. So whenever we think we've reached the peak, we're going to be saying that $2 million Leslie house is now $5 million and $7 million. We're going to look back and say, we should have bought 10 of them. Like my parents, we say to our parents, why didn't you buy 4 of them on the street? But it's still the best investment. But again, what's the lifestyle you want to have?
Great last words from Brian Gluckstein. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone on the panel for, you know, sharing your time, sharing your knowledge, sharing your resources. Amazing. And we'd also like to thank our sponsor, just once again, the RE/MAX Collection, for their generosity and support. On behalf of Post City Magazine, Streets of Toronto, along with the Rotman School, I'd like to thank the audio and video teams, our volunteers, and of course, all of you, the audience, who took your time and came out here tonight. We appreciate it so much. Thank you once again. Good evening, everybody. Have a great night.
Thank you for listening to Post City Magazine's Real Estate Roundtable, brought to you by the RE/MAX Collection. Special thanks to reception sponsor Callis Real Estate.